Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, Jim Potts back on the air, and as always, thank you so much for listening on your Sunday evening. Well, today we're going to talk about, and I've entitled this one, to be honest with you, I don't normally entitle these episodes, but this one today is called The Day of the Children. We're going to be speaking about some things that touches people's hearts near and dear regarding these school shootings. I came across some information that I thought was really good, so I'll be sharing that with you regarding kindergarten through 12th. It'll be incidents and stats. At any rate, the second thing we're going to talk about today is child abduction awareness. Serious things going on. So we're going to be talking about awareness and prevention. That's the key, prevention. But before we get into that, I want to do a little shout out here. Memorial Day is tomorrow. And I wonder how many of you actually know the history of Memorial Day. Well, it used to be called Decoration Day. And it was first done in 1865. And the reason it was done was to honor the 620,000 men who died during the Civil War. And, you know, that was the deadliest time in American history, especially in terms of the casualties. And as usual, you know, people will tell you that, you know, it was brother against brother. And unfortunately, you know, it was so horrible that many people would have died in a war against Americans, basically. But Memorial Day itself, okay, because like I said, Decoration Day is how it started out. But in 1882 is when they started calling it Memorial Day, so just to let you know that. So the shout-out goes out to the military personnel living and those that have gone before us. You know, we want to thank you for your service, all the branches of the service. Today's a day for them to be remembered. So for those of you that are out there that are listening, that have previous backgrounds or families with people that are in the service, you know, we send our congratulations out to you as well, because we know that there's a lot of sacrifices that you make as well with your loved ones. Okay, having gotten that out of the way, let's move on. You know, I always start out by reading these emails. So let me start out by reading an email to you. Jim, I keep telling my wife to be careful about using the internet for shopping because of things like identity theft and fraud. She says it's convenient for shopping and now banking as well. We listen to your show every week. Can you give us some safety tips on internet fraud? Signed, Pete. And then he has in parentheses, people, you ready for this? Not my real name. She's listening. At any rate, no problem, Pete. Let's talk about it. Look, there's no doubt about it. The more you use the internet, the more you appreciate the convenience and the access to services like banking and shopping. I mean, I get that. Those are the times we're living in. Unfortunately, it's also a main hub for exploitation that can sometimes seem surprisingly genuine. You know, now there's some telltale signs of typical frauds out there, along with safety checks, you know, that you can use to avoid them. And I'm going to share them with you in a moment. But before I do that, as always, I want to give you, in case you have any questions or comments that you would like to make, give us a call at 818-602-4929 if you have any comments or questions. And, you know, you can always find our phone number on the website also, on the LA Talk Radio website. So that's easy, so you don't have to remember to be writing it down. Just go to the website. Or you can send me an email, listenupwithjp@pottsassociates.com, pottsandassociates.com. So that's listenupwithjp@pottsandassociates.com. And if you want to get on my blog or email blast about the upcoming show topics, just text Potts Associates and text that to 22828 and enter your email address, okay? And you can find that information on the website as well. Okay, now look, let's talk about some telltale signs of the internet fraud. All right, and so let's talk about some safety things that you can do to avoid them. Now, I will tell you that the most common fraud arrives by email. claiming to be from your bank, your credit card company, or some other service that you frequent. It usually asks you to send your account details and sometimes your PIN, either by return email or through a website. Now look, various tricks are used to lower your guard, such as security and maintenance upgrades, investigation of irregularities, or bill charges that are due, etc. Don't fall for that okey-doke, guys. When you have questions about any of those things, look, keep it simple. Just get on the phone and call your credit card company and ask them whether or not they set anything out. That makes it very simple, because I can tell you that the fraudsters, they typically scan the internet for email addresses or generate them at random. So they don't know. They don't need an online service provider's mailing list to do this. Some may send just a few dozen emails, while others send thousands. And even if it's only a few unsuspecting people that actually bite on this, it could be worth the effort to them to break into their accounts. And, you know, we've heard other things about some of these credit card companies, et cetera, that have been actually hacked and all of that information out there as well. So you do want to stay on top of it. Let's just take a moment to talk about some safety checks to avoid fraud. Only use your PIN through the official login site offered by your provider. That's it. All right. Check official websites for announcements as well. And, you know, look, take a common sense privacy precaution, such as avoiding financial transactions on the internet. You know, these cafes, the libraries and all of that. Use some common sense with that. I know that the convenience is there and a lot of people, you know, will use it, but you know, there is a lot of fraud that's associated with that. So we want you to be careful, all right? And look, act quickly if you think you've been conned. If you get a suspicious email, look, tell your service provider. Get on it immediately, all right? And you can also, you know, double check with the the company that does the your credit checks, the credit check companies as well, all right? Okay, look, Pete, there's some information for you. Hope she's listening. Hope she doesn't figure you out and get you in trouble. But, hey, Pete's right. There is a lot of issues with this, so be very, very careful out there. Okay, the next email. Jim, I am outraged that they have released the American Taliban guy. The guy is still talking about killing Americans even while he was in prison. And now they're going to let him out 3 years earlier. How do you feel about it? And that's from Clancy out of Boston, Massachusetts. I don't know, but you know, I'll ask my listeners that as well. If anybody has a comment about that, again, just give us a call at 818-602-4929 and express some opinions if you feel up to it. Or you could send me an email. We could talk about it more next week. But for those of you who have not heard that news, it's all about an individual named John Walker Lynn. Now, this individual, there's some history here, guys. And yes, he's getting out of prison early, 3 years early. So Clancy is right. Now, but I want to say something before I get into the background of this guy a little bit. First of all, I will tell you that it's my personal belief that when a person serves their time, they serve their time. Look, it's not for us to say who gets out early, who doesn't get out early. He did 17 of 24 years. You know how I am. You know what my background was, even with law enforcement. But, you know, I'm not one of those strict guys that says, hey, you know what, he should have served his whole 20 years. I believe that he has served 17 out of 20 years. I believe that if they paroled him, it was for a reason. Even though he still has some issues, that's just the way that it is. And that's part of our judicial system. And we can't just give that up. If you recall, those of you that have read my book, Right to Counsel, I talk in there about the fact that we have to leave the emotions out of the judicial system. So I do recognize the fact that this guy is hopefully not somebody that's going to do anything else to us when he gets out. But they'll be watching him close for one thing. All right. But for those of you that don't know who he is, again, his name is John Philip Walker Lynn. Now, this guy was a United States citizen, and he was actually captured as an enemy combatant when the United States invaded Afghanistan in 2001. And he was detained. He was in prison. The bad thing is that he took part in a battle this particular battle where it was a prison uprising of Taliban prisoners. And a CIA officer named Johnny Mike Spann was killed. Now, look, there was about 86 of these people that did that out of about 300 to 500 prisoners that were there. So these individuals, 86 people that were involved in that uprising, so to speak, in the prison, they were brought to trial in the United States federal court in February of 2002. And Lynn accepted a plea bargain. He pleaded guilty to two charges, and that's why he was sentenced to 20 years in prison. Now, again, he was sentenced. He's getting out early. Now, sometimes people look at people's backgrounds. Now, I can tell you that this guy, Lynn, as an adolescent, participated in these different chat rooms. But those of you that have been regular listeners, you know that I've talked to you before about watching what your kids are doing on the internet. And he was on an IRC chat room situation, and he even had a nickname. And he became a devoted fan of hip-hop music and even engaged in extensive discussion on the use of internet news groups. And he even at times pretended to be an African-American rapper who had criticized others for acting black. Now, when Spike Lee's movie Malcolm X came out, he was impressed so deeply, and that sparked his interest in Islam. So, at the age 16, this guy actually formally converted to Islam, and he began regularly attending mosque in Mill Valley, which is you know, up by San Francisco. And he traveled to Yemen and stayed there for about 10 months to learn Arabic so he can actually read the Quran in its original language. So this guy really got into all of this at a young age. And then he ended up returning to the United States in 1999. And he went back to Yemen in 2000 and then left for Pakistan to do some further studying. So, I mean, look, this guy was all into that. And he's got issues, there's no doubt about it, in terms of where he is. And, you know, at the age 20, he decided to go to Afghanistan to fight for the Afghan Taliban government forces against the Northern Alliance fighters. And that's where he was when all of this broke out, and even on 9/11. So he was actually captured on November 25th of 2001. So that gives you a brief history of him, in all honesty. From what I understand, they're going to be watching him very closely because he's still espousing these political ideologies that really are contrary to our interest as Americans. But, you know, look, at this point, he's just talking. And to me, you just can't arrest people for that. So I just say, just give him a chance. Let's just see. And, you know, that's about all we can really do. But they'll be watching him close. And if he steps out of line, believe me when I tell you, he's on parole for 3 years. And if he steps out of line, he'll be back in jail. And and let's see what happens. All right, Clancy? So I know it's emotional for people. I understand where you're coming from. But, look, we've got a system of justice, and that's it. That's the way we have to look at it. All right, third email. Jim, I know you don't get into discussions on politics, but what is your opinion about the Russians interfering with the 2016 presidential election? Isn't that a form of terrorism? Paul, Indianapolis. Look, let me just tell you. First of all, we talk about terrorism. Occasionally I read the definition of, you know, of domestic terrorism, and it's really acts carried out by United States citizens or persons of United States permanent residence. I'm not convinced, to be perfectly honest with you, that that's really an act of terrorism per se, but, well, let me just back up. It could lend itself in that direction, and I'll tell you why. I just got finished reading the Mueller report, and in the Mueller report, as you know, there was issues about the interference. So a lot of what they were doing was technically by cyber attacks. So if you have cyber attacks technically, then, you know, the way that they were doing things and reaching out to people on the internet, arguably that could possibly be a form of domestic terrorism simply by the fact that it had to do with cyber. And you have to be careful with these cyber attacks, et cetera. So to me, I think it's a little bit gray, Paul. There's still a major concern about that. I don't think any foreign government, including the United States, really needs to be involved in other elections in other countries. The harsh reality is that these things do happen. And we just need to prepare for them like we need to prepare for anything else. So I don't know. I mean, you know, any opinions out there on this is welcome also. But that's just my opinion. I think that the Russians did do this. And I think based upon what I've read in the Mueller report, and I think it's something that we need to safeguard against, whether it's the Russians or any other foreign nation that actually interferes in our election process. And I think we need to take an aggressive stance on it. Okay. That's my opinion. Okay. Having said that. All right, let's move on now. Let's talk about something here. This is, you know, I tell people all the time about children, and we need to make sure that we're protecting our children without a doubt. And I do have concerns about this, and as we all should. And I tell people, even when I'm giving these speeches, et cetera, that we need to be able to watch what our children are doing, pay attention to what they're doing. This business about the internet and the radicalization, people getting radicalized. But it's not just radicalization. They see things on the internet, and then some of them become copycats. It's really what it boils down to. Now, let me just tell you something. This business about these shootings. Now, let me just give you an example. When I look at these stats by year, in 2018, guys, we had 97 school shootings, 97. And that is the highest number since 1970. I went all the way back. 1970, just to give you an idea, we had 19. That was it. 76, we only had 11. That was the lowest year. And you look at these numbers, and none of these numbers have been really close to 97. The only other year was in 2006. So what is that, 13 years ago? And that was at 59. So look at this spike. For it to jump up in 2018 and 97, that's horrific. And there's reasons for it. Parents have to be very careful of what their children are doing. Parents have to be watching what they're doing. And even with the recent school shootings where these two people got the guns, they got them from their parents. The parents have to secure the weapons, and we've talked about that as well. This is important. Obviously, it's important. The other lowest year, we had 11 in 1976, and then 2011 only had 13. How many do we have already for this year, guys? We're already at 18. We are already at 18. So you look at these numbers, there's reason for concern. Now, is what I want to do is spend some time getting into a little bit more detail with you about the incidents by time of day. So I've even got it down for you, even from that perspective. So look, is what we have found is that morning classes are when you get the most of them. And those numbers have reached, you know, in the past, you know, out of all of the incidents, don't forget, since 1970, I'm sorry, this goes back to 1970. So all of the incidents since 1970 until 2019, 286 of these shootings were done around morning classes. And those numbers far surpass, as you'll see in a second, evening classes, 159 during evening classes. Afternoon classes, 140. Lunchtime, 113. Again, this is since 1970. After school, very close to the lunch period. After school, 110 shootings. Then at dismissal, so when they were actually dismissing, it was 102. Now, as school is opening, so the opening bell, so to speak, 75. Before school, 72. Not a school day, which meant that it was at an event, 64. And then at night, 50. So when you look at those numbers, clearly it's the morning classes that hold the higher risk factors. 276, as I told you. So if you have to be a little bit more on guard, it's morning classes. All right. Now, let's talk about incidents by state, because I think that's important as well. So we do have that information available for you. Now, I'm going to tell you, living in California, I would have a major concern, because out of all of this between 1970 right now and present, believe it or not, California leads the way. And I was really surprised when I saw that. You know, you don't hear about all these things on the news sometimes. But California, since 1970, has had 157. 157. That is a lot. Texas was second. They've got 132. So California and Texas appear to be where the majorities are. Now, here's what's interesting is that Colorado, as we know, have had a lot of shootings also, but it appears that their shootings have been more toward, you know, not toward the 1970s, more toward the 2000 and, I don't know, 14, 15s and, you know, around that time. Colorado's had 16, but they have the most horrific of the shootings in terms of the number of people that were actually killed. Now, if you know, this all appears to be on the West Coast. Now, New York has had 47, so just to let you know that. And we have other states that 51 was in Pennsylvania, Ohio 54. Michigan was a surprise to me. Michigan's had 67. You know, and again, you don't really hear about all of those. Louisiana's had 44. And let me not leave out Florida. Florida's actually the third highest, and they had 87. So if you look at the highest ones, you got California at 157. You got you got Texas at 132. You have Florida at 87. And we know that there's been a lot of issues in Florida. And Illinois is backed up on that at 63. Well, I should say Michigan is at 67. And then Illinois is at 63. Again, these are numbers that are very astounding, quite frankly. Your smaller numbers are you're in your smaller states. You know, Vermont, Maine. I mean, those have like 2, 3. Rhode Island, but those are very small states. Wyoming's only had 3. Idaho's only had 2. You know, and again, that means when I look at this list, literally every state has had a school shooting of sorts with this active shooter. North Dakota has even had 1. Alaska had 9. So when you look at these numbers, they are very, very concerning. North Carolina's had 42, Tennessee's 44, South Carolina 26, North Carolina 42. So I don't know, you know, what the answer is for this, because people ask me that all the time. Well, like I said, the one thing that I think parents need to do is to be able to put locks on their guns. You can start with that, I guess, and don't be so lackadaisical about them having it, about these kids having access. Now, some of these incidents, you look at them and say, well, okay, well, how do these things end? So we even have that information for you. You know, out of all of the ones since 1970, they subdued or apprehended 788 of these shooters. And I think that that's a pretty good number, because a lot of times these people will also, you know, kill themselves and that's it. But you have other numbers that are good as well. You've got barricaded situations where they fled. Some have immediately surrendered. 138 of them immediately surrendered. The officer-involved shootings, though, those numbers are not really that astounding, in my opinion. There's been 104 officer-involved shootings, and I don't think that that's a huge number, quite frankly. Because a lot of times you got to understand with these active shooters, you know, aside from the schools, a lot of times this stuff is over in 5 to 10 minutes. Sometimes before law enforcement can even get there. And let's see, I think when we look at these numbers with these schools, now, people ask me, they say, well, look, what should the schools be doing? And I think some of the schools are trying to be proactive. I think a few shows ago I told you about how I think it's in New Jersey where they're trying to train dogs now to patrol the halls, and the dogs go after an active shooter. So when the bullets start flying, they basically, you know, have the dog attack the shooter. But, you know, the realities are if people are aware that the place is patrolling with dogs, they're probably not going to go there, or they're going to do it at a convenient time when the dogs are around. I mean, they're at one end of the school and they're at the other. So I don't know that that's going to be 100%. But, look, anything that we can do certainly is going to help. Now, the way I look at it, if you look at the school safety should have a lockdown procedure. And that means providing their staff with tips and information that they need to secure the school. Okay, that to me is of the utmost importance. Now, I'm going to tell you, because this is something else when I'm talking to people in the active shooter training that I do, there's no single guaranteed lockdown plan. You know, some places that call us and we go out and see them and we talk to them, you know, everybody wants to know, you know, what's the best way, and that's fine. But we have to tell them there's no guarantees to these things. Is what you're trying to do is eliminate the loss of life by having some kind of procedures in place, all right, so that the shooter doesn't have access once it starts going on. And there's no single guaranteed lockdown plan that fits every school. All schools have their campus protocols, their relationships with law enforcement, et cetera. And those are all different. And the plans sometimes are tailored to fit the needs and the layout of each individual campus. You know, I was talking to an organization the other day, and basically my team and I are going in, and it's a huge facility, and it's a college campus. And when we're looking at that, just the way that it's laid out, you know, it's very difficult, but there's plans that can be put in place. The biggest thing, in my opinion, is that they take the affirmative steps to do that. And, you know, it's the process. Now, it's extremely important and more common in present times to not let active shooter situations be the only drill that they train for, because that could be a failing. You know, back in the day, what did they do? Earthquakes, fires, things of that nature. But when you put these plans in place, don't let that be the only drill that they train for. Having only one type of lockdown plan can cause failure to perform during a crisis with variables that are different than the one that they prepared for. So you want to try to do different scenarios. You know, we've had people that want us actually to go in and do an active shooter situation and not tell the employees that we're going to do it. And I know some organizations out there that are selling their services, so to speak, where they actually will do that. They'll come in, you know, unsuspecting to the employees as if it's an active shooter situation because management wants to know how everybody will react. Personally, I think that's ridiculous. I think people can get hurt like that because even the people that are acting it out, okay, because they're not going to have real bullets in their guns, obviously. And you may have somebody in the organization that actually has a gun because they either have a CCW or they don't. And now all of a sudden, you know, the bullets start flying and it wasn't supposed to be a real situation. So I'm personally against that. My team and I have talked about it. So we don't personally do that. But I think people should shy away from doing that, in all honesty. Now, the counter argument to that, obviously, is the fact that, well, how do you truly prepare for something like that? Well, look, there's videos out there. There's different scenarios out there that you can do that's not necessarily surprising your people, because somebody could have a heart attack. There's just too many variables with that. Now, I'll tell you the other problem. Sometimes is what they want to do for businesses, as an example, is have codes. But codes can be problematic because using codes during communication of staff during drills can be a good thing, I admit that. But overcomplicating them or having too many can lead to confusion of the various codes and protocols for each during an emergency. Everybody's looking at each other, which code was that? Look, keep it simple if you're going to have it. Now, I will tell you also that all staff members should be informed and trained on the procedures. They should be provided keys and anything else required to do a lockdown during the particular areas that they may be in. You know, now that's something that they can physically practice. They can practice, how do you lock it down? How do you do it? That makes sense to me, so that it becomes second nature to them, so that something happens. You know, now there are some people out there that are of the philosophy that the classroom door should be locked while class is in session, you know, or when they're not being used. When they're not being used, I get it. But when you start talking about locking doors during class, I don't know what protocols are in place in cases of fire. But I'll tell you this, you got locked doors, and now all of a sudden there's a fire, and people can't get out for whatever reason, then there's going to be some liability and, more importantly, loss of life. So I'm not sure that I'm in favor of that one. But there's people out there that believe that that's one way to do it. This doesn't happen to be my opinion. I do believe the staff should be trained to respond and initiate a lockdown should any threat or incident, you know, begin away from the main office or an area that heads the school. So, you know, toward the front of the school, principal's offices, things of that nature. Because anybody comes in normally comes in through the front, you know. So I think that those need to be even more so on the ready and prepared, because they're toward the entryways. Now, I've had people tell me, well, what about the exits? I remember this movie, Lean on Me, and, you know, he was chaining the door, so to speak. Well, this fire code issues with that as well, so I'm not sure that that works. Now, I think that some of what has to happen is that people have to be in the frame of mind to be able to make the proper lockdown decisions. And again, that's going to be based on the threat. Practice, practice, practice. That, to me, is what we need to do. And not having dress rehearsals where people can get hurt. One of the things that I emphasize is what I call a reverse evacuation protocol. You know, the school needs a method of alerting and gathering students outside the buildings to get inside for the lockdown. You know, like a loudspeaker or any other type of audible alert that reaches everywhere on campus, you know, probably work. Phone alerts also, because now they have these different apps that people can buy, and the apps actually have it where it goes off. So something like those Amber alerts. So most people, when they think about these things, they think about evacuations, about leaving the building. But, you know, if you remember the Columbine situation, those kids started on the outside. So if you turn around and have a reverse evacuation plan where if something starts to happen, what do? You move in to the building. So you need that plan as well. Again, most people have it the opposite way. So keep that in mind. You know, and the schools, they need to have a method of being able to clear students out of the rooms in a quick and effective way. You know, whether or not, you know, trampling over each other. I remember with the fire drills we used to have in school, everybody had their protocol. Stand up, single line, you're heading out. You know, when there's an active shooter, you know what's going to happen is people that are going to be, you know, running all over each other because it's panic. But if we turn around and train them and have those kind of drills, in my opinion, I think that's what's, you know, that can be very important to do it that way versus the other way. You know, when we talk about this business with these schools, and people want to think that these things are new. You know, I've shown you this has been going on since 1970. And yet we still don't have an answer. The biggest thing for me is the schools at least trying to do something, the education. So for the parents out there, I fully urge you to talk to your schools where your children are attending. Find out what they're doing. And when you find out what they're doing, I think that these schools should also notify the parents. And that's why I also say for the parents to reach out there, because the parents can then emphasize to their children, you know, the same things, so that not only do they get it in the school, but it can also be reinforced at the house as well, you know, in the home. All right. Okay. Any questions about that? Give us a call. Let's talk about this other area now, these child abductions. Again, I told you today was the day of the kids because I've been reading some additional information on this, and there's still some there's always going to be concerns about child abductions, et cetera. But I think what's important with that is always just being able to refresh people for people to know exactly what they should be doing, what they should be looking out for, et cetera. Because I will tell you, the statistics show that every 40 seconds a child goes missing or abducted. Every 40 seconds. That is a lot. You know, a lot of times it's family child abduction. That is number one, the most common situation, family child abduction. Kidnapping by a parent or family relative, that's where you have to look out. And you may look at that and say, why would these people be doing it? Well, they do it for a lot of different reasons. And we'll be looking at a little bit of that as well. But 25% by acquaintances, you know, of the child. So there's a lot of times they know. They know who the person might be. Now, I can tell you, and this may seem like a very strange number to you, but believe it or not, less than one-fourth of these abductions is by a stranger. And not unsurprising, girls more often than boys. That's not surprising. Look, 80% of the abductions, you have to understand with the homes, 80%. Now, that number is very high because roughly 75% of abductions and murders, they happen within 3 hours of when the child goes missing. You got to understand the deaths, the murders, within 75% of the abductions within 3 hours of the child goes missing, the child is gone, meaning dead, murdered. That's a lot. So you got 3 hours when that child goes missing to start a manhunt as quickly as possible. And I can tell you that the majority of non-family abductions, 80%, are motivated by sexual intentions. That's the sad part. So the majority of the non-family abductions, 80% are motivated by sexual intentions. And again, I've already told you there's more girls than boys, which, again, sad but true. And it's also very, very logical. Now, we have to take a look at this because we also want to know where these abductions and what the trends has been. Now, there's studies out there that actually show, okay, on a 10-year analysis what the trends are. Trends are always important. And it's too bad that we have these things that happen where we actually have a 10-year study where we're looking at all of this. But that's what it is. So the school is one of the biggest factors in timing when these happen. 70% of these abductions happen on school days. 70%. Because why? That's when the child is probably most vulnerable. 70% school days. If the child gets outside of the school, they're not being monitored. Now, I will tell you that where my two youngest granddaughters go, that school has it laid out. There's no doubt about it. They got a sign-in and sign-out procedure. They have where, and a lot of schools probably have this now as well, where the parents get to write down who is it that can pick up their child. So that makes it the security pretty good, actually. But it depends where it is. Yeah, and you stop and think about it. The inner city school situations, in my opinion, are a lot different than the suburban places. And if you notice also on the active shooter situations at schools, take a look. Most of these things happen not in the inner city, happen in suburban. Now, in the suburbs, you got younger children walking alone or with a peer to and from school. I remember when my boys were younger, we had a neighborhood school, and that's true. Once we showed them a few times how to get back and forth to school, we let them walk to school. That wasn't every day, or walk home, you know, after school because we were at work, and we showed them how to do it. And they had the crossing guards and all of that as well. And a lot of times they do walk with a peer, but sometimes that's not possible, and they walk by themselves. Now, I can tell you this, children who actually got away, they actually ignored or refused the individual that was trying to coax them into that vehicle. Now, see, that's important. See, this again, goes towards parents educating their children. And I remember with my youngest son, and I asked him one time, what would happen if somebody in a van pulled up, pointed a gun at you, and told you to get in the van? What would you do? He said he'd be afraid, so he'd get in the van. And I explained to him, if you do that, we'll never see you again. Just start screaming. Run away. That's not, they don't want that kind of attention. That's the point. And they're pointing a gun at you to create fear. And that's what people do with guns. They do it to intimidate and create fear. But the children out there who have been properly disciplined about this ignore to refuse the person. And now with cell phones, these kids have cell phones. They can call. They can they scream. Or they had another child or an adult that interfered. They got involved in it. They intervened. So that's about the ones that got away. So when you're talking to your children about this, tell them. And you've heard the expression, you know, we've talked about this before. Don't talk to strangers. He's a stranger. Remember that one? That's the deal. Tell them don't talk to people that they don't know. You know, that book I wrote, Right to Counsel, let me just tell you, all of those girls, majority of those girls, believe it or not, were hitchhiking. We accept, with the exception of the youngest one who was not, but she still got a ride because she was upset with her sister and she wanted to go home. And her sister wasn't that much older than her, a few years older than her, but she was upset, and the predator saw something that was going on and convinced the little girl that he would take her home. And she got in the car with him. Of course, her parents never saw her alive again. But you don't talk to strangers. Force that on them. And for those of you that are in more rural areas, don't be out there hitchhiking. All right? Now, I will tell you that normally with these abductions, there is a certain amount of force that is used. These people will snatch these kids as well. But again, it's probably not in the inner city. Why? Because in the inner city, there's a lot of people around. So for those of you that are in the suburban areas, you want to be on guard for this. Make sure that you're talking to your children about these kind of things, because that's what's critical. Now, I'm going to give you a number that's really alarming, and I will tell you that there's an estimated 800,000 children that are reported missing each year now. And that's more than 2,000 children every day, they say. And it's five girls and one boy, okay? They'll be sexually victimized before the age of 18. Let me give that to you again now. Okay, so it's an estimated 1 in 5 girls and 1 in 10 boys will be sexually victimized before the age 15. Yet only 1 in 3 will ever tell anyone. 1 in 3. Why? They're afraid. They're ashamed. It's all of those things. Now, I can tell you, according to the United States Department of Justice, that less than 2% of all violent crimes against juveniles are reported to the police involving kidnapping. 2%. And understand that there are three distinct types of kidnapping. There's kidnapping by a relative of the victim or family kidnapping, which is about 49%, I'll let you know that. And kidnapping by an acquaintance of the victim, or acquaintance kidnapping, we call it. That's 27%. And kidnapping by a stranger to the victim or stranger kidnapping, we call this 24%. So we actually have classifications, you guys, of the kidnappings. So we got family kidnappings, acquaintance kidnappings, and then kidnappings by strangers. It's a shame that we have to put them in categories, but that's the deal. Now, according to the latest online victimization research, approximately 1 in 7 youth online, guys, receive sexual solicitation or an approach over the internet. What have I been telling you? The internet. It was a great invention out there, but it has its downsides. 4% received an aggressive sexual solicitation. That is by like a solicitor who asked to meet them somewhere, called them on the telephone, or sent them offline mail, money, or gifts. And 34% had an unwanted exposure to sexual material, such as pictures of naked people or people having sex. 27% of the youth who encountered unwanted sexual material told a parent or guardian. And if the encounter was defined as distressing, episodes that made them feel very or extremely upset or afraid, 42% told a parent or a guardian. But we need to once again indicate that to the children about these kind of things. But parents, you need to be proactive, because that's on you. I mean, I know you have a, you know, long day at work and all those kind of good things, and I get it, but you've got to do it. You've got to do it. There's no two ways about it. Now, look, there is some safety and prevention things for us to be thinking about. And the good news is that they have these sex offender registrations now where you can actually go online and look up some of this information and find out things about neighbors and other people that might be sex offenders. So that's out there. I'm not going to recommend any which one. It's for you to get up there and, you know, just go ahead and do your internet research, et cetera. But I can tell you that community notifications, you know, allow states discretion to establish their criteria for disclosure of these individuals. So there are some guidelines for this. Now, I will tell you one, because of Megan's Law, okay, that's out there. And because of Megan's Law, the states are really aggressive with some of this. But to me, there's also a downside to it, because we get calls from clients that somebody has gone on and looked on Megan's Line, et cetera. I've looked up Megan's Law, and then they went to the websites, and, you know, they've seen somebody's name from work, and now they want to tell the owner or the director of human resources, hey, I just looked up, you know, John Doe's name, you know, just casually, and he's a sex offender. Now the employer wants to call and say, hey, I want to fire this guy. And he's firing for what? You know, if he hasn't done anything, you know, at work, you got to be careful with that as well. And I can tell you that some of the courts have even said you need to be careful about going on those websites and getting employees' names off of them. Now, look, I will admit that depending on the business that you're in, if you're in a childcare business, then you are required to do that background check. But you can check that with the state and federal agencies that are out there. You check with them, but don't be jumping on those websites for like Megan's Law, et cetera, because that could be problematic. All right. Now, I have to be honest with you about something else, and that's a lot of these missing kids. You know, some of these, the largest number of missing children are most frequent. It's because they're either runaways, family abductions, they're lost or injured, all right? And like I said about the non-family abductions as well. Now, the custodial disagreements are important, because that's just what it is. Parents that can't get along, they turn around and they snatch these children and they go to other places. All cases of child abductions, guys, must be taken very seriously. And I can tell you that in most family-related cases, children are told that the left-behind parent doesn't want to love them. These children may live the life of a fugitive, always on the run with the non-custodial parent, isolated from family, friends, home, and schools. This, for me, is an issue with the parents. Divorces, having children out of wedlock with all of this, because it's two different categories. Look, the parents are the ones that have to get on the same page. If they don't do that, in the long run, they're going to hurt their children. Now, a common question that I've gotten in the past is that how a person can prepare themselves in case of a child becomes missing. So I want to end the show by giving you those tips as well. All right? The first thing that you need to do is keep a complete description of your child on hand. Take color photographs of your child every 6 months. If the child is 13 years old when they go missing and the last one that you have is when they were 5 years old, that's going to be problematic. So take color photographs of your child every 6 months. Have your dentist prepare and maintain dental charts for your child, and be sure that they're updated each time an examination or dental work is performed. Now, the other thing is, know where your child's medical records are located. So keep all of these things together. The other thing is, arrange with your local law enforcement agency to have your child fingerprinted and keep the fingerprints in a safe and easily accessible place. Now, I will tell you, some people don't like that. There are some people from the minority community that have spoken out against, well, I don't want my child fingerprinted. They're going to use that against them. Look, as we're talking about, raise your children the right way, and hopefully none of that will happen anyway. But this is for you in case they get lost or missing. Now, there are some people that even suggest parents keeping a DNA sample of the child. like an old toothbrush in a brown envelope, you know, lit closed by your child. That's very simple. Keep it at room temperature in a dry, easily accessible place that's far away from the heat so it doesn't, so you don't lose that. Now, hear me on that. A DNA sample from your child, like an old toothbrush, okay, here's what you do. In a brown oval, lick the envelope. Have them lick the envelope closed by your child at room temperature. So here's their old toothbrush. You put it in a brown envelope, all right? You have them seal it by licking it, all right? And then keep it at room temperature in a dry, easily acceptable place that's far away from heat, all right? And if a child goes missing, act immediately, guys. Don't sit on it. Okay. You've been listening to Jim Potts on LA Talk Radio. Unfortunately, it's time to close out the show. I'd love to talk to you more. But be sure to join me next week. Hey, do me a favor. If you like what you heard, spread the word. Until then, be aware, be vigilant, be safe. More importantly, be a reluctant victim. Until next week, guys.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.